Well, hello everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Born to Talk radio show. And I know you've probably been wondering, where have I been? Well, I took a little time off, but nothing is better than coming back to this podcast with an outstanding guest. And my guest today is Phil Frings. He is the president and the CEO of Logistics, and in 2017, he became the founder of the nonprofit Racing to End Alzheimer's Foundation. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Hello, Marcia. It is such a delight to have you feature us. I'm appreciative and thank you very much.
Well, I must tell you, I just got goosebumps, which is always what happens for me when I have guests that are with nonprofits, because I think there is just something so important about the nonprofit world. And I'm just so delighted that you're able to join us. And I thought you could just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself so we can get to know you.
Well, sure. I'm a California kid. I grew up in San Mateo in Northern California, and I came here to Southern California to go to college. I went to UCLA. So I started my business career here, it led me to working for 3M Company and then later Xerox. And through the Xerox relationship, I ended up being transferred first to Texas and then later to Ohio. And I think there's something special about living in other places, which some people don't get the chance to do, and I did. And it was great to be able to come back to California, where I really wanted to live, after I had a couple of little sojourns that were based on my business career. So I've been back in California since 1984. Uh-huh. And delighted to be here.
That's terrific. We have a common friend, don't we?
We do.
Would you like to tell our listeners who that might be?
Yeah, so I have an important person in my life named Josh Freeman. Josh is the founder and principal in Free Associates, which is a design and marketing organization that he founded. And he has supported my company for more than a decade, probably closer to 20 years. I don't actually pay that close of attention, but he is a right-hand man for us in everything that we do that involves communications, and has become effectively our chief operating officer for the Racing to End Alzheimer's Foundation. We don't make a move without Josh being in the middle of it. He's terrific.
How is it that I know him? Oh, I know. He's my neighbor. He lives down the street.
He does. He does. And by the way, speaking of racing, unfortunately, I have a window open in my office.
As I was going to say, we may
somebody want to just somebody just roared down the street.
I heard it. Well, maybe it was just somebody trying to announce the fact that your work associate and my neighbor are one and the same. So that, yeah. I just think that's great. So yeah, we'll see if we can not hear any more race cars going forward. But I wanted to just say, I understand that you're an entrepreneur and having started your own business in your 30s. Tell us about what that was like and more about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Some people grow up with the idea that they're going to start a business. And in my case, it wasn't that way. I was working with a couple of major companies and then some smaller companies that were trying to get into the space that I had experience in, which was the legal environment and document services. And at some point in time, the opportunity came my way to start a company that I thought would be focused entirely on Southern California. And over the 30 plus years that we've been in operations, we ended up having customers in all the major cities in the United States, and customers in Europe and Asia as well, all based on the ever-expanding legal world. And law firms that used to be regional are now global, and we ended up working with several of those firms, which gave us an opportunity to really grow far beyond my expectations with what I started with.
Wow. That's everybody has a story to tell. We all do. Some people like to share their stories, others don't, and I understand that as well. But I think that's what makes us human, is understanding that we all have stories, and that's What's Your Story has always been part of what I do. So was it difficult to start a business, to fund it and grow it?
Well, it was. It was for sure. I mean, in my case, I had a business partner and an investor that helped us get started that believed in our ability to do this type of work. And we got it going. And it was, you know, one customer at a time and probably very much underfunded. The term bootstrapped has application here. But we basically got it going and added customers. And after a difficult time for the first 2 or 3 years when my partner and I were not taking salaries and we were just trying to make this thing go, we finally reached the critical moment where all of a sudden we actually were paying our own bills, being able to take salaries, and eventually starting to create profits, which is the reason why anybody starts a business. And we achieved that. And so it turned out to be a very rewarding life for me, not only personally, but financially. And I'm very grateful for everybody that helped along the way, but I'm also happy that I took a flyer and decided to start something that I thought I knew how to do better than others, and it turned out that I think I was right.
So are we talking about logistics here then?
We are.
Okay, I think that was important to mention that, because that is the business that we're speaking about, is logistics.
It is. And the company was founded in 1989, and so we have grown through all those years along the way. But our customers that are principally large law firms that have a need to produce documentation associated with their practice. And for us, it means that we provide to those law firms equipment, technology, people, supplies, and know-how all inside of their firm so that they don't have to go out and acquire equipment or buy technology or hire people. They can outsource that process to us. It's something that we're expert in, that the document side of things isn't their expertise. Their expertise is law and advisory services. So it's an interesting business. It's somewhat of a boutique business, but it has been really rewarding for my employees who have grown along with this business, and certainly for my family and myself. And over time, I ended up becoming the only principal. My partner had to move on to do something else, and my investor at one point in time stepped aside. So the business has been my sole business for probably 25 years now.
Terrific. And you said 1989 is when you started?
It is.
Wow. That was just yesterday, right?
To some of us.
Yes, exactly. So when you look back at this, what were some of your key takeaways when you first started doing this?
Well, I think if you have confidence, number one, and number two, you're willing to take a look around and pay attention and learn, because just because you've done it before for another company doesn't mean that you're going to be successful doing it. So you have to learn, what you can do, what you can't do, and sometimes reduce your expectations a little bit and have some little wins along the way, not necessarily big wins all the time. And if you sort of layer this business one little win at a time, every little step makes a difference. And for me, I think that was my takeaway from my entrepreneurial experience was, figure out what you can do, recognize what you can't do, and try to stay in your lane, so to speak.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, a lot of people that listen to this podcast are in similar boats. And so I think this is very inspiring for them to hear that. And I know you've done a lot of volunteer work outside of your professional life. Please tell me how that happened in your life.
Well, Marcia, it's interesting. At some point in time, your business life is everything, particularly when you're entrepreneurial. But as you grow a business and you start hiring people and elevating people's responsibilities, pretty soon you become the coach rather than the player. And so when I became the coach, so to speak, and I had wonderful people working for me, all with important responsibilities and quite capable of doing things, to let them grow, you have to sort of step away a little bit and let them do their thing. And it gave me an opportunity to realize how fortunate I had been. And I don't know, I almost feel like embarrassed for the level of success that I had, that I thought that it was important for me to try to figure out ways to give back and do things for others rather than be completely one-dimensional, a business person. So I look for opportunities to be charitable, and I've been a golfer most of my life. I really like the golf game, and so my first couple of things that I did that were charitably pointed were in the world of golf. I started out with my alma mater, UCLA, has a wonderful women's golf program, but it didn't have the funding that it needed to be competitive. And I was introduced to head coach Carrie Forsythe, who coached for more than 20 years there, and she was a brand new coach at the time. And so we partnered together with her and with Alicia Holmes, who is her longtime assistant, who's now the head coach. And we created the opportunity for us to basically get some funding opportunities. We did benefit golf tournament. We did some things that would allow us to create community, you know, create boosters and alumni and people that were interested. And so we did that and have done that all these years. In fact, I'm going off to a meeting on the 21st, on Friday, for the upcoming benefit tournament, which will take place at Valencia Country Club on November 2nd, that benefits the UCLA Women's Golf Tournament, or golf team. It's called the Bruin 18, so I'm looking forward to that. And then after I got involved with that, I was introduced to the Southern California Junior Golf Association's foundation. Got involved in scholarship work there, you know, trying to give kids help for their college education if they had been involved in our programming. You know, these are children that in some cases were handed a golf club for the first time at 6 or 7 years old, but as they worked their way through elementary school, middle school, and high school, college was ahead of them, and it was an opportunity for us to make a difference for a lot of these kids. So we had a scholarship program, and then ultimately I was worried about our ability to fund it at the levels that we wanted. And so I formed a tournament. It plays at Pebble Beach. It's Ooh. A professional and amateur tournament. There's a team with a club pro and three amateurs. And we've grown it to have 20 teams every year, every March. And over the 14 prior years, including this past March, we've raised about $2.5 million that has all been granted out to these children. And the really cool thing, Marcia, is in some of these cases, these children are the first person in their family to even go to college, let alone to have earned part of their college expenses by their performance and their love for the game of golf.
Wow. That gave me goosebumps. That must be just must touch your heart. Because it's not about you, and I can definitely hear that. It's about what can you do to help others, and that's what makes you so remarkable. And whether it's the women or the children, it's really impressive.
Well, thank you. It's been very, very rewarding to me, and I'm really happy that I went down this path.
I bet. So this advocation that you have for motorsports, how did you end up with this in your life?
Well, you know, that's the interesting. It's an interesting story, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. So, I don't want to bore your listeners. Your listeners want to hear some interesting stuff. This may be more interesting to me than others, but I was playing golf up at Pebble Beach in a golf tournament, and I ended up being assigned a caddy, a really nice young man, and we played. At a golf course up there called Spyglass, one of the most difficult of the courses. And the first five holes of that course are unbelievably difficult and very tricky. And they were a real stressor for me. So I was basically working with this caddy and hardly talking to him because I was so concerned about my performance. And after we got through those first five holes, we got into holes that were a little bit more, generally as expected. They were hard. It was long and difficult to play, but it didn't have, we weren't hitting between sand dunes and other kinds of tricky little things.
Right.
And so I finally talked to this young man, Nick Galante is his name, and I said, Nick, how did you end up here? Are you from here? He says, no, I'm from Massachusetts, and I had a back injury from snowboarding, and when I recovered, I figured I wanted to do something dynamic in my life, and I knew how to work in golf. I had caddied back there, but I wanted to learn how to become a race car driver.
Oh.
And sure enough, Monterey is the home of Pebble Beach Resorts, world-renowned, and also the Laguna Seca track, which is in Monterey, and there was a racing school. And so I said, well, that's really cool, Nick. I was always a race car fan as a kid growing up, and even as a young adult, I always enjoyed racing. And so somehow between the sixth hole when I started talking to him, rather than being scared with the first five holes of the course...
Yeah.
He's a pretty good salesman. By the time we finished the round, we walked off 18. I was discussing with him how I could help him in his desire to learn about racing. And next thing you know, I became a sponsor for part of his racing school. And so he went off to racing school for a couple of years. And I would show up when he had competition at the end of the couple of days of racing school and help pay his entry fees so he could compete. And that led us into the world of international motorsports. And so since 2008, I've been sponsoring a race car. Generally speaking, it was to promote logistics, my company. But as time went on, we got a little different idea. But in any case, Nick and I have traveled all around the United States involved in sports car racing. We have raced Porsches and we've raced Audis. We've raced... BMWs, we've raced Fords. So we've been doing this for a long period of time, and it's led us to another opportunity that exists, and that was I had an unfortunate turn of luck in my life when my wife was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the end of 2013. And so it changed everything in our lives. I basically had to sort of stay home for the first couple of years to be there for her and provide support and care and ultimately be her caregiver. And after a few years, it became clear to me that it was beyond my ability to do that job. And so we engaged professional caregivers to come in our home and take care of Mimi, who is... by this time starting to have real difficulty in just everyday life. And so once we made that decision, I went back to the racetrack. And while I was at one of the tracks, I was inspired. There was a team that was associated with the Marine Corps, and they had on their large transporter, the thing that pulls the truck, the cars and all the equipment. They had the names of Marines who had been killed in service. And the whole side of the truck was covered with these names of these Marines. I have a college friend of mine, one of the guys in my wedding, fraternity brother, who lost his son in Iraq. Sure enough, there was Captain Matthew Manoukian on the side of this thing. I took a picture and sent it to my classmate Pete, and he was very moved by the whole thing. And I just had like an aha moment. I go, well, wait a minute. So Mimi and others are suffering from Alzheimer's. What can we do about it? And what if we put names of these people on the side of a race car instead of the big corporate logos, in my case, the logistics logo, and in some of the other cases, sometimes they're pretty garish and ugly logos, but they, you know, that's how motorsports is funded. So anyway, we started in 2017, the Racing to End Alzheimer's Foundation, with the sole purpose of adding the names of people who have been affected by Alzheimer's or who are currently going through their final journey in this horrible disease as a way to honor them. So people donate to our foundation to get the opportunity to add a name to the car. We try to cover the car over all these seasons. We're in season 10 right now, but over the first 9 seasons, we've averaged about 200 names per car, and I'm able to match the $250 donation with funds from logistics, so we end up with $500, and then we have other people that come along the way that like what we're doing. So we raise between $100,000 and $150,000 every year.
Wow.
And so we have made this, well, I would just describe it as my passion project. It's something that makes a lot of difference. Sadly, Mimi passed away in early 2025 after 12 years from her diagnosis. But she lived her best life as she could at home with the care of really wonderful, loving caregivers. And so we did the best for her, and she did the best that she could under this burden of this disease. But so we're still out there doing it. So Racing Dead and Alzheimer's is in its 10th racing season, and through the first 9, we've raised $1,200,000.
Oh, my gosh.
We have chosen a couple of really wonderful beneficiaries. I'd like to tell you about them, if that's all right.
Oh, I would love to hear about that.
Okay. Well, the one that's near and dear to our heart is UCLA's Alzheimer's and Dementia Care Program, 100% grant-funded, and it provides to people who are patients at UCLA and their families, more important, their families, support to the caregiving process. So they have educational curricula, they have respite care strategies, they provide social and psychological help to the families who have among them somebody affected by this disease to help them see it through to the end. It's a marvelous thing. It started at UCLA. It has now been adopted by many other of the hospitals around the country that have specific Alzheimer's units, and it's being modeled. It actually has support from the federal government, which is remarkable, because in these days we don't hear about support coming out of the government, but in this case it has been. So I love that, and one of the doctors up there, you know, said, hey, if you can help us, it will really make a difference. And so that became one of our beneficiaries, which I love. The second beneficiary is probably a more interesting story, because I was introduced to Jim Nance, who is the longtime CBS sportscaster, the prime broadcaster for NFL football for more than 20 years now, and also the voice of the Masters and the PGA Tour on CBS. And Jim lost his father to Alzheimer's, and when his father was first diagnosed, he was living in Houston, so Jim's father was treated at Houston Methodist Hospital in the neurology group, the neurological services. And after he passed, he had the disease for 13 years. And about 12 years ago, Jim and his family helped sponsor and found the Nance National Alzheimer's Center, which is one of the leading research organizations for Alzheimer's and dementia. And they've done a marvelous job. All the clinical trials that go on, they are at Houston Methodist and the Nance National Alzheimer's Center, as well as many other universities and teaching facilities around the country. But Jim has been a wonderful supporter of ours. He's made videos to help us get our message out. He's just a perfect gentleman, maybe one of the nicest people on the planet. And I'm so grateful for that introduction, because the people at Houston Methodist are phenomenal. And I can't say enough about them.
Wow, that's your I love stories. I love hearing about how things get started and what motivates people. And I guess this all started because you had found a purpose.
I think you're right. I mean, I think it, well, first of all, for what I've discovered, particularly when I'm at the racetrack, is that, you know, if I get a chance to talk to people, I would say it's 7 out of 10 people have somebody in their life, could be a family member or somebody otherwise close that's been affected by Alzheimer's. So this is not a unusual disease anymore. It is hitting all of us all the time. And what I do say about it is, you know, Alzheimer's is a disease that, in particular, affects an entire family, not
right.
just a person with the disease. It becomes, the whole family is engaged and involved in this because they have to be. And as a result of that, you know, I just know people are affected to the point where they may be in despair, they may be depressed, they may have all kinds of other things going on. And so for me, you know, because of this opportunity, I was able, and because of great caregivers at home, I was able to go out and go talk about this, have some purpose, as you pointed out. But it may, it hits great. And, you know, I've been teased that my job at the track, because we spend a lot of time at the track promoting what we're doing and showing people the names on the car and everything. And you know, somebody will come up and look at a name on the car, and they might be quite stoic about it. They might be sort of stiff upper lipping this. And then all of a sudden, as we talk about what we do, it will be revealed that they have somebody in their life who has been affected and maybe passed or is affected right now. And all of a sudden, the eyes get a little glassy. That, you know, the stoicism breaks down a little bit, and next thing you know, because it's been in my life too, you know, I end up having, you know, reaching out if they're approachable and hugging them, and saying it's okay, and so I've been described as the hugger in chief in the paddock, but we all shed a tear, and it seems like a unbearable type of thing, but it's going on in everybody's lives, and so we have to bear it, and we have to be supportive to each other. And every time we do something, we're just making a little tiny difference, but all those little differences may make a big difference.
And you know, I wonder if people are wondering this, and I'm not sure if I would think that you're able to answer this. Could you tell us what the difference is between Alzheimer's and dementia? There is a difference, right?
Well, dementia is, I think, the global term that talks about when somebody's brain starts losing capacity because of cells dying in their brains. And I think that's what dementia is. Alois Alzheimer was a doctor in Germany in the late 1800s that had in that village some woman, you know, early older woman, right, middle age to you know, maybe 70s or something like that, and she was, you know, people thought that she was having mental issues, but you know, she just wasn't her same. And after she died, he dissected her brain and found where there were sections of the brain that no longer had living purposes.
Wow.
And so that disease is called Alzheimer's disease based on him. And as an aside, that patient's name goes on our car every single year.
But that's dementia, you said, right?
Yeah, and she's the first one to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
Okay.
There are many forms of dementia. There's vascular dementia, which sometimes occurs after people have had strokes or other events. There's frontal temporal dementia, which is in the news these days because Bruce Willis, who is, you know, younger than most people that would have Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia, has frontal temporal dementia, and it's a disease that generally hits people between their late 50s through the end of their 60s. And so he's been diagnosed with that. And coincidentally, that same disease, FTD, or frontal temporal dementia, was the disease that Robin Williams had been diagnosed with, and as you may recall, he took his life. So there are different types of dementias, but generally the most common form of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. But we don't want to preclude anything because, you know, if somebody in your family has dementia, we're not gonna not want to honor them the same way we honor somebody that has a more common form of dementia, which would be Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, so if you were like making an outline, dementia would be like Roman numeral, or would be one, and Alzheimer's is underneath that.
Correct. It might be A, B, or C.
Yes. Okay. That's very interesting. I really wasn't aware of that. So if I didn't know that, perhaps somebody else didn't as well. But I think it's really wonderful how you've been able to add what you love, honor your wife, and make a difference in so many people's lives, including golf. I mean, that's pretty remarkable too, what you do there. So it sounds like you have a life that has tremendous purpose, and I think that that's important for all of us. And everybody's purpose is not the same. Everybody's lifestyle is not the same. But when you find something that your heart is just so happy with, there's something to be said for that, don't you think?
Well, I would agree. I mean, you know, this wasn't part of a grand plan in my life.
Sure.
Just was circumstances were such that it allowed me to, you know, ponder, think, and then pursue something that was maybe a little bit more unusual. But in any case, the idea of accomplishment first, and then, you know, if you feel accomplished and you have some energy and time to reach out and try to do something beyond that, it's extraordinarily rewarding. And you know, and I think for all of us, we should be looking for ways to give back, pay it forward.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be a big thing. It could be a little thing. It could be volunteering,
right.
You know, at the library. It could be...
Time is money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you know, it's whatever somebody can do. And in my case, you know, what I think has been good for me is the idea that my charitable pursuits have involved me encouraging others to give,
mm-hmm.
and in some ways activating the charitable side of other people. So I'm a big believer in this concept of matches. And so, as I indicated, I've been matching names on the car. And, oh, by the way, I should have said, too, that, you know, we start every January, and we put the first name on the car, and at the end of the season in October, we're done. And then the next January, we start again. So we have many, many people that repeat every single year. And then, of course, we're adding new names, new families that want to honor their loved ones as we go. So that's how we can achieve the largesse that we sort of have developed in terms of raising funding and getting out to those two beneficiaries of ours.
That's great. Is it always the same model of car that everybody races in?
No, you know, it's very interesting. We race in two series right now. We race in the IMSA, which is for the International Motorsports Association. And we're in a class of cars or a series called the Michelin Pilot Challenge. So Michelin is the sponsor of the series, but we're in what's called GT4 cars, and they're all sports cars. So within that series, we're racing against McLaren, Aston Martin for a couple of the exotic brands, Mercedes, AMG, Porsche, BMW, also Ford, Mustang, Chevrolet, Camaro. These are similar to the cars we see in the car dealership, but they are purposely made race cars, and that's GT4. And then in the other series, we're in a series called Pirelli. It's SRO is the sanctioning body, and it is Pirelli GT4 America. And in that particular series, we're running a BMW. And so we're running against all those same brands of cars. And so I'm going one weekend off to an IMSA race, and then maybe 2 weekends later I'm going off to a SRO race, so therefore Pirelli GT4. And so, you know, I get to travel a little bit. It's good. It's good for the frequent flyer points.
That's cute. And so, so I'm just trying to understand this, and you're explaining it really well, and I know you must go to these races. So when the races are happening, how many cars are in a race at one time?
So in the Michelin Pilot Challenge, which is a larger series, there are 40 GT4 cars, and simultaneously there are probably another 30 or so touring cars, which are front-wheel drive cars. They run in the same time. You qualify against your class of car, and then the other series qualifies, and then as the race goes on, the cars sort of get interspersed. And so there's like 70 or 80 cars on the track at any given time, but 40 of them are our class that we're competing against.
Okay,
and,
so what are the other 30 doing?
Well, they're racing for their championship inside the same Pilot Challenge. So Pilot Challenge has two classes of cars, GS, which are the GT4, and TCR, which are the front-wheel drive race cars that are smaller. They're Audis, and they're Hondas, and they're, trying to think of some other brand, but they're just a different car, not quite as powerful, but actually quite nimble and quite effective on the track. But the power of the GS cars, we start in front of them, and then if there's a incident which causes a yellow flag, then they will reorder the cars so that you don't have to drive around slower cars. So these races are two-hour races, except for twice a year we have a four-hour race, just to shake things up. But it's fun. I love going to the track. I like being a teammate. It's fun. I mean, we have these series are two drivers per race, and so there is a changeover during a pit stop between your first driver and your second driver. All of that is based on strategy and tactics as to when you come in, because they have to fill up the gas and they have to change the tires, and they have to determine when the right time to do that is. So there's some strategy involved. And so, we have a whole crew. We have tire changers, we have fuelers, we have a engineer that manages things, we have a data scientist that is keeping track of all the data. So it's really quite a unique operation, and I'm there to talk to people about Alzheimer's and coerce and encourage and try to get them to put a name on the car. So I'm a teammate with all these people, so it's really fun to be part of a team working towards a goal. Sure. And, we've been fortunate. When Nick was driving with us, my caddy, we won the national championship twice in 2016 and 2018. So we've had some success along the way, and there's been other years that we haven't had as much success. We tend to have moved from team to team based on their availability, because they have to be willing to give up some sponsorship to allow us to put the names on the car.
Sure.
So I always have to find the right circumstance, right situation for us.
Right. So when the cars are racing, how many cars would be in a typical race?
Like I said, in the GS category, which are the GT4s in the Michelin Pilot Challenge, there's about 40.
Okay.
But simultaneously on track, there's another 30 cars that are racing in their series as well.
But not at the same time.
It's confusing, I know. It's hard to fathom, but if somebody goes to IMSA.com and looks up Michelin Pilot Challenge, they'll have an opportunity to see video to see photographs. And all the races are available on YouTube as well. And they're broadcast on Peacock, which is NBC's cable network.
Right. So not 70 cars on track at the same time.
Yes, 40. No, 70 cars on track at the same time.
Car total of the 40 and the 30 all at the track on the same time. And
exactly.
Is it based on how many times they circle the track to know when the track, when the race is over?
Yeah, I mean, the race is based on time. These are timed races.
So they will start
the green flag and the checkered flag will drop at 2 hours if it's a standard race. Or if it's what we call the endurance races, which are four-hour races, it will occur then. And so everybody's out there. And then, you know, when there are incidents, they slow everything down. They have yellow flags. If there's a big incident, they have a red flag. They'll stop the race until they can repair a tire barrier, for example, that may have been hit. So for safety purposes, they'll stop everybody. But it's very exciting. It's, I don't know, there's something about going to the track that, I would describe it as it's sort of sexy because basically, you know, these are all handsome dudes. They're getting in and out of their car, and it's loud, and you know, it's that way. And then, of course, many of the women that are there are delighted to be at the track, and so the whole vibe is really electric. I would say it's sort of an electric thing. And if people haven't been to one of these races and it comes somewhere close to them, they ought to go.
Sure.
You know, we race in Sonoma up in the Bay Area in the Pirelli GT Challenge, and we race at Laguna Seca in Monterey, but we race it in Daytona and Sebring and Wisconsin at Road America. We're all over the place. We even race in Toronto.
That's interesting. So did I understand you to say that, so you're in this car, you're the driver, and it's based on time, that you may have gotten out of your car and somebody stepped into the car you were in and continues to race?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
By the way, the you is not me, because I am not a driver.
Oh, I don't know. but, someone.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cute.
Yeah, but, you know, the driver teams, you know, they get themselves put together. And in some cases, like our team in Michelin Pilot, is Sean Quinlan, who is a businessman, actually a computer scientist, who has just retired from Google after being there for more than 20 years. When he started at Google, there were 500 employees, and now there's 150,000 employees. So you can get the size. He's a PhD from Stanford. And so he's racing. The second driver is Greg LaFouge, and Greg is a professional driver and coach. So he is Sean's coach and has taught Sean his racecraft. And so they race together as a team. So Sean is the qualifier. So he qualifies the car, and he's in the car first. And then when we make the change mid-race, Greg gets in, and Greg is now one of the fastest guys on the track. And so most of these teams have a combination of an amateur and a pro. So more often than not, the people starting the race are the amateurs and the pros are the finishers. And sometimes you'll have two amateurs and sometimes you'll have two pros. So it just varies by each configuration that each team is willing to put out there. But it's very exciting. And
I bet it's loud.
It's very loud, you know. I mean, at one point in time, one of our marketing people said that our purpose to talk about Alzheimer's at the track was to get loud about Alzheimer's, because sometimes people take these neurological diseases and they don't talk about them very much. But, you know, so our purpose is to be loud about Alzheimer's.
That's I think that's great. Do you have to be at the racetrack to participate?
I don't. I choose to be there.
Specifically, but if somebody was listening,
they can. First of all, online on the IMSA.com site is a both a radio broadcast and a audio broadcast of the race. And then on Peacock, which is NBC's cable sports venue, they televise the races as well. And then on YouTube, the races are always available on YouTube. In the case of the Pirelli GT4, they're alive on YouTube, but the Michelin Pilot are there for, as soon as the race is over, they go up on YouTube. So you can certainly watch them. And in our case, you'd be watching a very cool-looking purple car that has some red accents on it, and the whole side of the car is covered with names of people that are loved so much by somebody that they want that name on the car.
Right. So, of course, if somebody wanted to get a name on the car, their loved one, their husband,
yes,
their wife, grandma,
yeah,
they could go to your website. How would they go about doing that?
Okay, well, the website is called R, the letter R, the number 2, ENDALZ.org. And if
you
go
say
to
that
site,
wait, say
yeah,
it one more
please,
time.
Yeah, so it's
R.
The letter R, the number 2, ENDALZ.org.
Oh, it's End Alzheimer's, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so it's R to End Alzheimer's.
Okay.
And if you go there, there's information about what we do, and there's a place where you can hit a button and says add a name.
Okay.
If you do that, it will take you to a place where you can add the name of your loved one. We ask you for the hometown or a town that's associated with them, because if we have a John Smith, we want to know it's the John Smith from Providence, Rhode Island, versus the John Smith from some other town. So we
sure.
That's a further identifier. And so that allows you to put the name on, and then it will send you to a site where your donation is made to our foundation at the California Community Foundation, which is our donor-directed fund, which sends out the tax receipt and holds those funds until we're ready to make our grants. And then they send the money out to the UCLA Alzheimer's Dementia Care Program or to the Nance National Alzheimer's Center in Houston.
Okay. I have to make sure I get that information on my... I have your website that I will be putting out there, but does...
Yes.
On your website, does it talk about the R2 and Alzheimer's.org?
Well, that is our website. That is the name of our
name
website.
Of your website. I'm sorry. I should have...
No, that's fine. And,
okay.
And if people want to have more information about what we do, we're active on Facebook and Instagram.
Right.
And it, no fancy letters there. It's just Racing to End Alzheimer's. So
okay.
Anybody can go to Facebook or
sure.
Instagram or even LinkedIn, and they'll find out more about us. We use the social media platforms to not only talk about the racing, but we also talk about things going on with Alzheimer's patients and dementia patients and families. So it's educational as well. So we try to share inspirational stories and, you know,
that's
updates nice. To things that are going on from a medicinal standpoint or caregiving strategy. So, you know, we try to be there for that. And, let me go back to the website, though. One of the really cool things we do on the website is we have what we call the Wall of Champions. And so irrespective of whether you're adding a name to the car and making a donation, or if you are, you certainly can do this as well. But it's a place where you can send a photograph of your loved one and then write a little something about them. And it stays up on that site forever. It's not like a new campaign every year. But it's a place for you to memorialize somebody who is gone, or to just pay tribute to somebody who is, I use the term, in their final journey. We know that Alzheimer's is not a curable disease, and so it ends up in somebody's death. But it's a great way for family members to acknowledge somebody that they love. And, you know, when I see these people at the track who see their loved one's name on the car, The emotions that they share and demonstrate is very heartwarming.
I'm sure that's true. So R2, I'm when we get off this call, I'm going to make sure I have this accurate, because I didn't realize that was the way your .org looked. I thought it was actually spelling out on
yeah.
Listen
we tried to make it short. Maybe we made it more confusing. But anyway, once again, it's R2ENDALZ. And that two is not the word T-O. It is R, the letter, two, the number, ENDALZ.org.
Okay, well, I'll make sure that I fix that on my post, because that isn't what I have there right now. So
yeah.
What is it all meant to you to be involved in this like this and so committed for your time and your effort?
Well, I mean, it certainly helped my sanity personally going through this experience with, a member of my own family. And at the same time, when I'm out there at the track and I get a chance to talk to people, I know what they're living with or have lived through. And so it is a great way to just be supportive. And it gives me, to your earlier point, it gives me some purpose in and around this unlucky event that occurred. And so I feel like it's important to do, and I feel like doing what we do helps. And sometimes it may be somewhat healing for somebody to add their loved one's name. Certainly it is a way to recognize them, acknowledge them, and remember them. And families do it together. You know, it's interesting. We oftentimes it would be like $250, and I see people that I can tell that seems like a lot of money to them, and you know, and they'll say, yeah, my grandma. And I go, well, let me ask you a question. How many siblings do you have? And more importantly, how many cousins do you have? You know, and all of a sudden they say, well, there are 12 of us. And I go, okay, that's basically $21 each. So, call everybody up and say you're in for $21 and fill the paperwork out and get it done. And we send out wristbands that have the names of those who have been added to the car as a sign of support. And then we also take a picture of the car on track and produce an image of the car in its racing mode with an enlargement that shows where the loved one's name is on the car. So those are mementos that people get. We're trying to add value as best we can.
How many cars are typically in a race at one time?
40 in the GT4 category, which is called Grand
Sport.
That's
right.
Yeah.
40. And so if they're in a race and these 40 cars are in a race, I'm a sports person, so is it seasonal or is it year-round?
So,
how does that work?
So the racing season starts at the beginning of every year. The first race of the season is at Daytona, and it is on the same weekend that the 24-hour Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona takes place, which is one of the biggest sports car races in the United States, only slightly less important than the 24-hour Le Mans, which is in France. And same type of cars. And so we race it's the last weekend of January. Then Sebring, Florida is another historic track that's been active since the 1950s. We race there in March. And then we get real busy in the summer months. We next raced this past year at Laguna Seca in April. Then we raced at Mid-Ohio, which is not far from Columbus, Ohio, in May. And then we raced at Watkins Glen, which is south of Rochester at the foot of Lake Seneca. It's a grand old town where racing first got started in the United States in 1948. So it's a historic place. We race there at Watkins Glen. And then from there, that's in June. Then we go up to Toronto in July. And then in August, we race at Road America. I just came back from Road America a couple weeks ago. And that's north of Milwaukee at Elkhart Lake. Also historic. And then we race at Virginia International Raceway, which is on the North Carolina-Virginia border. I'm leaving for that race next weekend. or actually this upcoming weekend. I'm leaving for that race on Thursday. And then we race at Indianapolis, which is the, you know, it's like the cathedral of racing. It's like going to Notre Dame. And so we race in Indianapolis. And then after Indianapolis, we finish the season at Road Atlanta, which is just north of the city limits in Atlanta. So that takes us into October. And then the other series, we have similar tracks, different times. And we race in November in the Pirelli GT4 America. So basically, by the time we get to the middle of November, we're done, and then the off season takes place. But everybody's got to get ready to go for IMSA Michelin Pilot Challenge in Daytona in January, and it's a big event. It's a lot of fans show up for that. So it's a seasonal sport, Marcia. So we're doing this, and every year, you know, the teams sort of change. So, you know, one team maybe retire, a new team may show up. Drivers change from one team to the next from different times, and so it's interesting. Every year is a new year.
Yeah, you know what? I just was wondering. I can't believe that this is likely, but I'm being a prejudiced person when I say this. Are there ever any women drivers?
Oh, there are women drivers.
Oh, there are.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Oh, no, we have women that are driving in both of those series all the time. I wouldn't say that it's large. I mean, if we have 80 drivers competing in the Michelin Pilot Challenge, there might be 9 or 10 women who are driving. Cool. But there are quite accomplished women drivers, particularly in sports car.
That's neat. Have you always been interested in race cars?
Well, I got involved. When I grew up in San Mateo, my next-door neighbor was from Indianapolis, from Indiana somewhere. So every year when the Indy 500 would take place, back in the days before it was televised, he would have a radio, and I'd be cutting my parents' lawn, and he'd be cutting his lawn, and then we'd go sit down and listen, and he would describe for me his experiences as a little boy going to the Indianapolis 500. And so he got me sort of engaged and involved in it. And then they used to show the Indy 500 race the following Sunday on Wide World of Sports that used to be on ABC on Sundays. So I would watch that, the replay of it. And so I got involved and was interested. And then I got more involved when I have a daughter who got interested in racing. And so we used to go to IndyCar races with my daughter Katie.
We took
the whole family to Indianapolis a couple of times to watch the big race over Memorial Day weekend. We took all three of my children and Mimi and I, and we went to the race a couple of times because it's sort of like a seminal event on an annual basis. It's, you know, I mean, there's more than 500,000 people there on race day.
So in this last couple of minutes that we have together, what's up next for you, my friend?
Well, you know, I'm going to continue doing this, and we're trying to find ways to do more than just the racing thing. I've driven across the country a couple of times during COVID, for example, and shortly thereafter, in a car that had the same livery, and I visited car dealers. And, you know, one year it was BMWs, another year it was Porsches. So we tried to create the activity that we generate at the track off-site. I hosted a golf tournament, a pro-am golf tournament here in Palos Verdes several years ago with the LPGA to invite people that were interested in supporting our cause. And we had a great event. We raised $100,000 that day by participating with the LPGA. We're going to have an event on October 26th at Willow Springs, which is a racetrack in the high desert here, where people are coming together that are interested in this, that are going to pay to have track time and bring their own cars up there and drive and add names to our race car as part of the program. And so we're doing that type of stuff. We did a museum tour last year at a private museum of car collections. And so I'm trying to come up with different ways for us to do what we do, but I don't think we'll ever stop adding names at the racetrack. But we want to do other things that get us to a broader and wider audience.
Well, I just want to say thank you. Thank you, Josh, for the connection.
Yes.
And for you, Bill, for this. People are going to have learned so much, and I will make sure that they can access this information. And I just want to say thank you, sir, for what you're doing, because you are changing the lives of so many people. And I know that it's in honor of your wife, and I'm sure she would be very proud of you.
Well, thank you, Marcia, for helping us spread the word.
You're welcome. Okay, so go out there and jump behind the wheel, and not on your neighborhood. Don't drive that fast there. And see about checking out these races, because I think you'd be in for a real treat. And so until next time, everybody, have a great week. And thanks again for joining me, Phil. Bye for now, everybody.
Thank you.